Well, good morning. Some of you here that are maybe more familiar with the Anglican tradition and the readings that are often assigned at our great feasts will know that the traditional readings for All Saints are not those that we read this morning. In fact, the lectionary does give us the option of using the readings for the Sunday, as it is called, Proper 31 in this case. And I chose those readings over the traditional All Saints readings because November the 4th is also the day on which we commemorate Old Testament saints. And today in our readings we're, I think, as I will argue in my sermon, confronted with a beautiful example of an Old Testament saint, though not a traditional one. Excuse me. It's remarkable, really, but in a story written over 2,500 years ago, a story that deals with traditional, rural, peasant farming life, the conundrums of modern urban living are already visible. What do I mean by that? Well, having to move from the place of your roots when you can't find work there, becoming an immigrant in a foreign country to find any kind of life at all, losing husbands and coping with widowhood in a society in which women are often routinely mistreated, and maybe most modern of all, undertaking cross-cultural and inter-religious marriages and wondering which community you really belong to. That's where we find ourselves at the beginning of this slim book of the Hebrew Scriptures, the Book of Ruth. At first, it would appear to be a book not suited to the theme of the Great Feast of All Saints, one of the four greatest feasts of the Christian tradition. But as in issues of modern culture and society, it proves itself remarkably adept. You see, we need lived examples of what Jesus' summary of the law in our gospel reading might mean, what it would look like, actually. And this book gives us one of those. And because this example is so unlikely, at least in terms of who we might traditionally imagine to be a saint, possibly it can confront us anew with the theme of the day and speak to each of us, irrespective of gender, irrespective of social background, irrespective, again I say, even of religion. What might it mean for us, modern people, to live into the fullness of our own calling on this great feast day? Well, the story begins, as all really good stories do, when things go wrong, or with things going wrong. The famine in Bethlehem and surrounding regions is severe, but it's also just one of those things. There's no indication that it's an act of judgment. Just a really, really bad stretch of weather. And I'm imagining there's places all around our globe that are going to be increasingly themselves experiencing these kinds of extended patches of bad weather in the decades to come. As a peasant farmer, Elimelech was like the majority of the population, just a couple of bad seasons from starvation. He hears that things are better in Moab. Now, if you've ever had a chance, had the privilege of being on the West Bank, as I have been privileged to be and to work for 3 months in the little town of Beit Jala, which is next to Bethlehem, you know that on a clear day at least, you can look east across the deep Jordan Valley, the Dead Sea at the bottom, and glimpse the mountains of Moab, that's modern Jordan, on the other side. Of course, there is no, 2,500 years ago, there was no love lost between Israel and Moab, the ancient equivalent of the Palestinians and the Jews. So for Elimelech to take his family there might be tragic. And it certainly will be humiliating, but he's not about to sit around and watch his family die. As the story goes, bad things continue to happen. Elimelech dies, perhaps after several years in Moab, the strain of the work, probably as a semi-slave to some local tenant farmer. Perhaps that was just too much. Perhaps he died from a broken heart, a sense of failure as the breadwinner, a sense of shame at having to abandon his farm in the Promised Land. The story doesn't tell us, partly because this isn't a man's story, it's a woman's story. It's Ruth's story, but it's also Naomi's, Elimelech's wife. There's this subversive element that runs throughout this book. Not only is it the story of women, it shows no shame when Naomi's sons marry Moabite women, women who serve other gods besides Yahweh. Naomi's sons die as well, 10 years later. Again, it's just stated, matter-of-factly, no judgment is rendered. Even though this is terrible, there is no sense that these things shouldn't happen, couldn't happen, or that God was the cause behind it. And so, best we can surmise, at about 40 years of age, Naomi is left alone in a foreign country with two foreign daughters-in-law of very different religious faith. When she hears that the famine is over in Israel, the story mentions God for the first time. Throughout the book, it will be reticent to do so. Again, quite radical for an ancient document. Not unheard of, but still quite radical. But I think very congruent with how you and I experience God. We too experience God somewhere in the middle of stuff that just happens. Somewhere in the muddle of coincidences and human initiative. We too, if we're committed Christians, believe that God is with us, in us even, though we usually hesitate, if we're wise, to say precisely how it is that God is working in and through history, in and through our actions, in and through our decisions and choices. Now, in the rains that have finally returned to Bethlehem, Naomi senses God calling her to return. Now, she has, in truth, very little choice. The abandoned family farm would have still been there. The right of return would have been hers. And it would have beckoned to her, even though there is no strong young man or men to till its soil. The two daughters-in-law set off with Naomi, but we need to remember that they themselves have never been to Israel. They would be, if they went with her, repeating the immigrant experience of Elimelech and Naomi and their two sons, but with the added hurdle of leaving a more pluralist religious culture and joining a more fundamentalist one. I have an uncle and an aunt who grew up in the 60s. Let's just put it there that way. They come from hippie culture, and at one point in their teaching careers, they decided they wanted to go make some more money, so they left Canada to teach in schools in Saudi Arabia. And it was very interesting listening to their stories of what it was like moving to an extremely fundamentalist country. They managed for a few years and then hightailed it back to more pluralist and friendly environs, namely Nelson, BC. Perfect hippie country, if I can put it that way. I know this is a bit anachronistic, but seeing Israel as a bit more of a fundamentalist society isn't completely off base. They were far more upset about foreign deities than the Moabites would have been. And there's no place in Israelite society for the Moabite god of Chemosh. For good reason, I would add. There isn't a lot of good cred or publicity that goes with this god. And so Israel would have had very little tolerance for Moabites. They saw them as traitors. They saw them as backstabbers. and you just need to cross-reference earlier parts of the Hebrew scriptures to understand where they're coming from. So the two daughters-in-law who would have worshipped in a Moabite way leave back to Israel with Naomi. Orpah, almost said Oprah, how many lectors made that mistake this week? Orpah and Ruth, the three of them together are a family. It's that they, in fact, are the only source of consolation that Naomi has left. But Naomi is feeling cursed and doesn't want the curse to fall on these two daughters-in-law the way it appears to have fallen on her husband and sons. And so she reminds them, you have Moabite families. Better to go to them, and perhaps there you'll find other men to marry while you're still young. Naomi refers them back to their homeland in an interesting way. She asks them to go back to your mother's household. It's just another one of those ways that the story encourages readers to resist the patriarchal stereotype. It's just when Naomi's bitterness and lack of hope have reached their bottom that the good news of God begins to percolate to the surface. Orpah and Ruth are offering Naomi another way of looking at family. It will be an odd kind of family in a traditional culture, but it's going to be family. But Naomi, she can't see it. All she can see in her mind's eye is the traditional nuclear family, and that's not what these three women are together. Again, how modern of this ancient book. The good news is offered in subversive social structure. I just encourage the listener to consider at least what the book is saying here. The hand of the Lord has turned against me, Naomi says. At this point, Naomi has expressed the hope of the Lord for her daughters-in-law, but she can't quite, like Job or the psalmist, talk to God about her own suffering, her own disappointment, her own lack of hope. Like many of us, she talks a lot about God, and I'm as guilty of that as anybody, but can't quite make the connection to relating to God on a more personal or even social level. And so, because this is natural to do, reads the bad things that have happened to her as God's judgment. Though, as I said earlier, the author of the book seems to have a different perspective to all of this, at least an ambiguous, neutral perspective. Orpah, the one daughter-in-law, listens to Naomi and relents. She's put on a brave face about going to Israel, a foreign land for her, but Naomi has convinced her that her home is, well, it's her home. And though she weeps aloud, she loves Naomi and Ruth, she goes back. And she has not, the book is clear, again, not to make any judgments here, she does not make an inferior choice to Ruth. She's a little like Naaman, the Syrian general, who goes to Israel to get cleansed from his skin disease, comes to recognize Yahweh, and then goes back to Syria, or the wise men who travel from the east to acknowledge Jesus, then return to the east where they are from, presumably to their own religions as well. There was no understanding in the ancient world of religion separated out from the social milieu, separated out from the regular practices of gathering together and worshiping. No understanding of religion as private thoughts you had in your mind. Naomi blesses Orpah to go and urges Ruth, your sister-in-law is returning to her people and to her gods. In other words, you go too. But where Naomi seems mixed up and confused and unable to see what's right in front of her face, the commitment of her daughters-in-law, Ruth is full of clarity. She will not be put off from going with Naomi. She is committed to Naomi. Naomi's people, Naomi's place, and Naomi's God. And she's committed to till death do us part, if you will. And even death won't part her from her commitments, she says, in an extraordinary speech. Ruth is, I think, though I've never heard it preached, a powerful example of what it might mean to love God whole, heart, body, soul, and mind, as in the exchange in our gospel today. To love God in a completely undivided way is to be undivided yourself and undivided in your faithfulness to those God has called you to be with and to serve. It is to be committed in this undivided way that is the hallmark of the saints. On this great feast, we remind ourselves of what is possible when God's Spirit wells up within us and calls from us the commitment to live in the presence of the one holy and undivided Trinity. To live in an undivided way in the midst of a fragmented and very, very divided culture. Some might read Ruth's story fairly conservatively. She's sticking with what she knows, with Naomi, family, kin to kin, that sort of thing. But in reality, she exhibits what all the saints exhibit, a commitment to God and therefore to others above all. Where to next, God, is her question. Not in the context of I need something new and exciting in my life in order to feel alive, but rather, where to next in the context of her undivided commitment? When I look at this community of St. Matthew, I understand that hard times, stuff that just happens because, even famine-like experiences, are the regular lot of living at one time or another for each of us here personally, and for the community as a whole. And yet none of us, not one person here in this room, like that scribe in our gospel reading, are far from the kingdom. Jesus is with us in this community, in the reading and proclamation of the word, and at this table, and in our interactions with each other and our attempts to reach out and be the love and compassion and justice of God in our work and in our world. The question becomes, will we together, will we as individuals, like Ruth, take the risk to keep moving from merely talking about God, about Christ, to fully committing to God, to loving God whole? And if we do that, if we take this step that all the saints take, we will find, along with Ruth, St. Thomas, St. Matthew, and all the saints, that all along God has not been sitting idly by, but all along has been committed to us, has been loving us whole to such a degree and with such wholehearted compassion that our sins have become Christ's sins. That our places and our times have become the Spirit's places and times. And that the stuff that just happens, even the hard stuff, is there to open to us the possibility that we might encourage one another and see in that encouragement the possibility of fresh commitment. That is my prayer for all of us as we tread the path of the saints together. Amen.